Doing well. Nice to see folks back. Hope it was a good week. We did a tough sugya last week, so went through a long and elaborate structure. Today is going to be very different. Today is going to be targeted shorter passages, a lot more midrash halacha, really getting into the psukim, the verses behind all of this stuff, and seeing some of the ways that a midrash, if read carefully and well, can really illuminate. All right. So again, there is this file where I dump some stuff for those who like to see, not just on the shared screen. And we're in the middle. We're in the middle of that file. Let's get started. All right. So we are still working off of this long list back in our Mishnah about the things that are different between Dine Mamonot and Dine Nefashot, between civil, monetary law, and capital cases. And back in the Mishnah, we've been talking about machzirin, okay, right? Dine mamonot machzirin, bein lizchut, bein lechova, dine nefashot, machzirin lizchut, ve'ein machzirin lechova. And our elaborate sugya last time was really focused on the how, that is to say, what are the parameters that we apply in order to decide sort of in what cases we do reverse, we don't reverse. Most of what we talked about there was monetary cases. So it was really the dine mamonot side of it. And now we're moving to the dine nefashot side of it, which is to say both laying out a little bit of the parameters of when and in what way do we reverse a capital case? And we're going to get into what is the basis for that in the Torah. So specifically, again, in the Mishnah, it says, Dine nefashot machzirin lizchut ve'ein machzirin lechova. Capital cases are returned, revisited, retried in order to play to the benefit of the defendant, to potentially exonerate one who was just convicted. But you do not revisit or overturn a verdict for exoneration in order to provide more damning evidence and to potentially put the person back on the block for execution. All right, so our sugya is going to pick up here. I'm going to read through this piece as a full unit, kind of quickly, as a sugya, and then we'll go back and I want to look at a whole bunch of parallels and ask a whole bunch of questions of that. All right, so beginning here, Tanu Rabbanan, Minayin liyotze mi beit din chayav, ve'amar echad, yesh li lelamed alav zechut, minayin shemachzirin oto. How do you know that if someone leaves the court guilty, right, sentenced to death, and then someone says, I have something, I have some exculpatory evidence, I have something I want to teach, how do you know that you send the case back to overturn the conviction? Because the Torah says, Talmud Lomar Naki al Taharog, you shall not kill a Naki, an innocent person. Uminayin li yotze mi beidin zakai. Ve'amar echad yesh li lelamed alav chova, minayin she'ein machzirin oto? Talmud lomar, tzadik al taharog. How do you know that if someone comes out exonerated from Beit Din, and someone then says, hey, I've got some damning evidence that will convict this person, how do you know that you do not send the case back? Because the Torah says you may not kill a tzadik, a righteous person, but here, as we'll see, clearly being read, someone who was cleared with a verdict, who was vindicated. Amar Rav Shimi Bar Ashi, v'chilufa lemesit, says Rav Shimi Bar Ashi, but the opposite is true of both of these cases, for a mesit, for someone who incites other people to idolatry, dichtiv, because it says, lo tachmol v'lo tachase alav, do not have any pity on them, and do not cover for them, might be the best idiomatic, but don't have any kind of support for them. Rav Kahana matni miki harog tahargin. Rav Kahana taught that this tradition with respect to the mesit being dealt with more severely comes from the phrase, you shall kill, yes, surely kill him. Ba'amine Rabbi Zeira me Rav Sheshet. Rabbi Zeira asked Rav Sheshet, chayve galuyot, and we have the printed text as minai, and the marginal note here tells us to read it as my, that is to say it as a question, chayve galuyot, those who have been sentenced to exile, sentenced to be sent off to one of the cities of refuge for having committed an act of manslaughter, basically not enough to get them on for murder, but not something that is a complete and total freak accident. What is the story with that? We learn the answer from rotzeach, rotzeach. The word murder is used in two contexts. It links the case of exile to the case of other murders. That teaches us, presumably, that they have the same rule. If this is all sounding confusing, it's confusing to me too. We're going to retread it in a minute. Chayve malkuyot, people who are convicted, expected to receive lashes, the same question. And when they answer, atya rasha rasha, the double use of the word rasha, a wicked person, links this case to another case. Tanya Namiachi, there's a braita that accords with this Amoraic tradition. Chayve galuyot minayin, atya rotzeach rotzeach, chayve malkot minayin, atya rasha rasha. Okay, let's go back, try to understand what happened here and what's going on behind the specific text here. All right, the first braita here is basically a question about this rule that the Mishnah talks about, which is to say that we, in fact, return, we overturn, we revisit a guilty conviction in a capital case, but we do not revisit a vindication, an exoneration in a capital case, is grounded in psukim, in verses, okay? And it's what seems to be two verses here, Naki al ta'arog and Sadiq al ta'arog, but these are actually the same verse, all right? So I'm going to take you over to another context here to understand what's happening and what the midrash is that we're actually reading. This is in the document that I put up earlier. Okay, here's our verse, which is relevant. Shmot Kaf Gimel, Pasuk Zayin, Midevar Sheker Tirchak, V'naki V'tzadik Al Taharog, Kilo Atzdik Rasha. Okay, now, if you were reading this on a plain surface level, you would say that Naki and Tzaddik are just synonyms, right? This is a way of saying, do not kill innocent and righteous people. Do not use the capital justice system to take down people who don't deserve to be killed. Kilo atzdik rasha, because I will not find a wicked person to be just, to be righteous, which seems to just be, particularly the verse taken as a whole, stay away from falsehood, not in the sense of don't tell a lie, but stay away from systems that basically perpetrate injustice through lies. Don't kill innocent people as part of your criminal justice system, because you will then be a wicked person and I will not tolerate it and consider you to be acting justly. Right? That seems to be the plain sense of the verse. But read closely, of course, you don't have to be a master darshan to know that the double v'naki v'tzadik is going to attract attention. Why are we talking about two different figures here? They must somehow be two different people representing something. And the way it's going to get read is naki is going to be the term that talks about an innocent person. Tzaddik will have to be something different, okay? That is to say, you may neither kill someone who is a naki nor someone who is a tzaddik. A naki is an innocent person. A tzaddik is someone who got off with a exonerating verdict, okay? That is to say, so here's the thing you have to, first is very surprising, right? Actually, what tzaddik means is, a guilty person who was nonetheless cleared. Okay? Naki means someone who is innocent, who is potentially going to get killed, stop them from being killed. Tzaddik is a guilty person who has nonetheless been at least temporarily exonerated, and you may not kill them either. Okay, now, just to sort of give a little more back, sort of backing to this midrash and this reading, because this is always the case with midrashim. You gotta read well. The word naki, in fact, has that meaning of innocent in a number of places. Right nearby in Parshat Mishpatim, v'chi yigach shor et isho et isha v'amet sako yisakel ashor v'lo yachel et besaro uval ashor naki. What does that mean? If an ox gores someone and that person dies, so the ox should be stoned. You may not eat its flesh. And this u here should really be read as, however, the owner of the ox is innocent. Right? The owner of the ox is not to blame for the fact that his ox went crazy. As opposed to, v'im shor nagachu mitmol shilshom, if it was already established as an ox that multiple times gored people, and the owners were warned and they didn't watch it, and then it killed someone, well, then you stone the shor, v'gam be'alav yumat. And also, the owner is to be put to death. Right? That's not read that way in rabbinic law exactly that way, but just in terms of what the Midrash is playing off here, right? Naki is basically the opposite of the other case where the Baal, the owner, is liable, okay? So don't kill an innocent person, great. But also tzaddik, that may sound like a stretch, and it's true. Most cases where you would find the word tzaddik, it's, right, Noach ish tzaddik tamim haya bedorotav, or any number of places where it's about the person is righteous. But in fact, if you look in Dvarim, where they are talking about court procedure, and they are worried about flogging going past the point of what a person can tolerate, such that it might kill them, or even if it doesn't kill them, they basically might lose control of themselves and be debased. The description of the scene that leads up to that is, ki yariv ben anashim eding shu ala mishpatu shvatum, when two people have a fight, and they go to court, and they get a judgment, v'hitzdiku et hatzadik v'yirshiu et harasha. That phrase doesn't really mean, and they will justify the righteous person and vilify the wicked person. It means they'll go through the process and they'll decide who's in the right and who's wrong. And sort of by getting the verdict of being in the right, you get the title tzaddik. That is to say, tzaddik. And in some ways, this is actually perhaps even more etymologically fundamental, right? Tzaddik, the way we use it to mean a righteous person, actually means someone who has been justified by God, right? Someone who somehow has been pronounced by God to be a good person. But tzaddik means the wheels of tzedek, of justice, have pronounced you in the right. So going back to the verse, we can now see the basis for the Midrash we'll read a fuller version of, which is, v'naki v'tzadik al ta'arog, neither kill someone who is innocent, nor kill someone who has already gotten an innocent verdict. Okay? So that leads to this midrash in the Mechilta, which is what we just basically saw in our Gemara here, but I want us to see it played out. And there's another piece that we've been sort of dancing around throughout in our learning, which is kind of what's God's role in this, what sometimes seems like an incomplete justice system. And I think this text really makes it very explicit. So the Mechilta, the early Midrash on Shmot, says the following. V'naki al taharog. Harei sheyatza mi beit din chayav, umatzu lo zechut la'achar mikan. You get a guilty verdict, but then after that, there is exculpatory evidence that comes to light. Shomea ani ehei chayav. Could it be that the guilty verdict would stand? Talmud lomar v'naki al taharog. No, you can't kill an innocent person. This person is innocent to the extent you have evidence that can be brought to establish that. So you got to make sure you're not killing an innocent person because that is forbidden. Yachol keshem sheyetze mi beit dincha zakai, kach yetze mi beit dini. Talmud lomar ki lo atzdik rasha. kind of haunting line. Could it be that just as this person will come out of your court vindicated, so they will come out of my court vindicated? Torah says, ki lo atzdik rasha. Now going to the end of the verse, ki lo atzdik rasha, which I had to read as boomeranging back to the judge, right? When I read the verse in its plain context, I said, you know, distance yourself from lies. Don't kill innocent people because I won't tolerate wicked people, which is, who are the wicked people? Judges who kill innocent people. But actually that requires a kind of flip of subject and object. In a way, the verse is read much better, just going up here again, midvar sheker tirchak v'nakiva tzadik al ta'arog ki lo atzdik rasha. The Midrash wants to say, don't kill a naki or a tzaddik person because I won't justify a wicked person. Meaning, you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't worry about the consequences of following this because don't worry, I do not justify wicked people. Back to the Midrash. So what's the point? You have someone who just received a guilty conviction and you feel like you followed the process and you really in fact got the evidence out there and you kind of feel they're guilty. And now someone's coming forward with evidence, which is potentially gonna let them off. And you understand it's your procedural obligation to reverse. And you also get that sometimes there's evidence that's going to fundamentally alter the case. It may not actually be compelling, but it may be enough of a technicality to get the person off. Says God in the Midrash, don't worry, I will take care of them in my court, right? I do not allow wicked people to be justified, so you leave it to me, but my priority is your courts never execute an innocent person, okay? That's the first side. The second side, the tzaddik al taharog, harei sheyatza mibeidin zakai, gets an exoneration, ve'achar kach matzu lo chova, and then there is damning, incriminating evidence. Can you in that case reverse and go back and convict? Talmud lomar vitzadik al taharog. You cannot kill a tzadik. That is to say, someone who was already exonerated. And here too, again, where it's much more direct. Oh my God, really? I'm going to let them go even when this damning evidence has come to light? You think they'll get off scot-free in the divine court? Talmud lomar lo ki lo atzdik rasha. Don't worry about it. I'm going to take care of it up in the heavenly court. Okay? So back in the Gemara, that gives you a sort of fuller sense of what this Midrash is doing, how it's working off of the text with the Naki and the Tzaddik all of that. And what you get when you look at the parallel, which is very powerful, is what's between the lines here, but explicit in that text, which is God can tolerate and in fact demands a criminal justice system that is full of holes because there is an assumption that God will plug those holes. Okay, now, question this, I think whenever we take texts like this, you know, from one context to another, how does one, if at all, apply that to a more contemporary setting? So, you know, I think that's very complicated. I think there's some who approach a text like this and sort of say, oh, here's the sort of rabbinic imprimatur for whether it's, you know, not quite being opposed to the death penalty, but being very, very limited in terms of what a capital justice system can do. That's what Jewish values push towards. And there's certainly a basis for that here. We also can't deny that. I think it's probably a little disingenuous to hold that position if you don't have the equal conviction of the Mechilta that God will get the bad guys. Now, I think they lived in a world where they didn't necessarily see God getting the bad guys either. So this may be more of sort of an article of faith or principle of ethics than it is an assessment of how the world works. But nonetheless, it's something to sort of think about of how we turn that corner in one way or another. Okay, great. So after that Braita, we move on here. And we get the statement of Rav Shimi bar Ashi, followed by a statement of Rav Kahana. And they say the opposite, it's exactly the opposite when dealing with the Mesit, okay? That is to say, when dealing with someone who has incited people to idolatry, then you both reverse an exoneration. That is to say, if you've exonerated someone who was accused of incitement, and then damning evidence comes to light, you revisit that evidence. And the reverse is also true, which is if you have convicted someone of incitement, and then exculpatory evidence comes to light, then you do not consider it. The case is closed. Okay, the exact opposite. And what's the proof? Lo tachmol velo techase alav. Don't have mercy or cover up for them. Now we're going to go and look at the verses in a minute. That's a fragment of a midrash. Like, that's clearly not enough. There's something more going on there. You see a midrash like that, you have to go investigate what happened in the fuller context here. As is ki harog tahargenu, which does sound like a strong statement of kill. Yes, kill him. But there's got to be more going on. Okay, so here too, and you know, the way you find this kind of stuff is not because you have full bikiyut in the Mechilta and the Sifrei. You use the incredible tool of the Yafei Einayim in the back of the Talmud Bavli. I know many of you are familiar with it. For those who are not, in the Vilna edition of the Shas, of the Talmud Bavli, is an amazing tool, the Yafei Einayim, written by a 19th century scholar, which does all the parallels from the Talmud Bavli to the literature of Eretz Yisrael. So the Yerushalmi, the Midrashei Halacha, and all of those things. So let's just look at this for 1 minute here, because here you'll get also an appreciation for how's the Midrash working. Okay, so this is the Parsha of the Mesit. Ki yisitcha, achicha venimecha, uvincha, uvitecha, eshet chekecha, your closest relatives and best friends in the world come to you, baseter, lemor, in private, and say, nilcha venavda Elohim acherim asher lo yadata atav avotecha. Let's go worship some other god. So then the Torah says, and listen to this, okay? Lo tovelo velo tishma elav velo tachosencha alav velo tachmol velo techase alav ki harog targenu yadcha tiyeh bo varishon alamito v'yad kol ha'am b'achrona. Your hand shall be the first to strike him down and everyone else will follow. But before that, we get this incredible series of verbs. Don't display any willingness to go along with him. Don't listen to him. Don't have mercy on him. Don't have compassion for him. Don't provide him with any cover. Rather, kill him. Here too, you could be a beginning Midrash student and want to know, oh my God, why so many verbs? Right? Why all of this? Why not just harog targenu, mot yumat? Or lo tishmalo. What do you need this litany of things, which is very powerful in the sort of cadence of it when you read it? I've read this passage a number of times, you know, in the Torah and Shul. If you've ever done that, you sort of know how it feels. And of course, when playing on an assumption of parsimony of language in the Torah, and every phrase is worth its weight in gold, what do each of these phrases add? Right? They've got to each be adding something. Again, on the pshat, it may just be a sort of dramatic way of saying, this is terrible, don't listen, you know, don't give any aid or comfort. But the Midrash is going to play this out much more. All right, so let's look at this. Sifrei Dvarim, the early Midrash from the school of Rabbi Akiva on Sefer Dvarim. So what does it say? Lo tovelo, that first phrase. It's an amazing passage. Miklal shenemar ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha yachol ata ohev lazeh. You're supposed to love your neighbor. You're supposed to love this guy, the inciter. Talmud lamar lo tovelo. First phrase is to say they're out of ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. Ve'lo tishma elav. Miklal shenemar azov ta azovimo yachol ata ozevim zeh. The Torah says when you see someone and their animals struggling with, you know, packages, and you got to help them back up. Could it be you're going to help this guy when he's by the side of the road? Talmud lomar velo tishma elav. That's injunction number two. Velo tachosein chalav. Miklal shenemar lo ta'amor al dam reyecha yachol yata rashay la'amor al damo shel zeh. The Torah says you can't stand idly by on your neighbor's blood, right? Understood to be you can't be passive when this person is at risk of dying. is it, could it be true that you're not allowed to be passive while the inciter, the mesit, is dying? Tamud lomar velo tachos eincha alav. Of course you can stand there and do nothing. That's what the next phrase says. Velo tachmol, lo tilamed alav zechut. Note, have mercy for him. Don't pull out some sort of exonerating claim in his favor. Here we've already moved into the courtroom. Velo techase alav, don't provide him any cover. Im ata yodea lo chova, I ata rashai lishtok. And if he has been exonerated or is being exonerated and you know something that would incriminate him, you are forbidden from withholding that information. You must step forward. Minayin shim yatza mi beit din chayav, she'ein machzirin oto lizchut, Talmud lomar ki harog. And how do we know that if he leaves the court guilty, you never go back to free him? Talmud lomar, it says, you have to kill, rather kill. And if yatza zakai, if he gets off, how do you know that you bring him back to try to convict him? Talmud lomar, tahargenu. Playing here, not really so much on the repetition, it's a little the repetition, but the notion that there's sort of two kinds of killing, right? There's the killing that you do when you undo the exoneration, and there's the killing that you do when you are maintaining a guilty verdict, okay? So what we now see, which you can only see by going to that passage in the Sifrei, is that actually Rav Shimi bar Ashi and Rav Kahana are both sort of bringing fragments of that larger midrashic complex. That is to say, it's not just like lo tachmol ve lo tachaseh alav kind of falls out of the sky as producing this rule. There's a whole robust midrash about the ways in which the repeated phrases there add more and more aggravated stuff. Our version in the Sifrei actually doesn't put this point on lo tachmol ve lo tachaseh alav, that you can't reverse, right, or you let go the verdict. It does really what Rav Kahana does, right? Ki harog tahargenu, which we see is also from that larger piece, but both of them are preserving a memory or a version of that larger set of midrashim and readings, which is very closely tied to the text, right? I want to really emphasize there's an idea here, but there is also really a reading of an unusually intense passage in Dvarim. Okay, a couple other comments here just to take note of. Yes, double jeopardy. Yes, Judge Bartnoff, do you want to weigh in with a further comment on this comment you wrote here?
There isn't a whole lot to say except that the whole notion is that to the extent that you can, you only want to try the case once. And if the government doesn't get successive bites at the apple. So you got to try the best case you have, and that's the best case you have. Now that works for the defendant as well, because they've got to make judgments. And the fact that they realize that maybe they had a bad strategy and something, maybe there was a witness they decided not to call for various reasons, they can't come back afterwards and say, oh, I should have done that. And I guess one question I have for you, Ethan, is whether what it means to have new evidence in this text. Does it mean, or in this system, yeah. Does it mean, because it seems to me it's one thing if it's new evidence that you didn't otherwise have, which in our civil system only works for the defense and not for the prosecution. But it doesn't mean evidence that you knew about, but just decided you didn't want to bring to the, you know, to the judge.
Right. So yeah, two comments on that. I would say the evidence that I think they're imagining here is overall something sort of new that has come to light. That is to say, it's not necessarily something that you've held back, that we did see a little bit of a fear of that kind of manipulation in one of our earlier weeks or earlier discussions. But overall, in theory, this would be, I just discovered this and now I need to bring it forward. But I would say it's overall a pretty low bar. And we'll see this as we go forward to some of the other material, sort of a notion that like, yeah, like a student who's sitting around may have something to contribute. And in that sense, the word evidence is not always even the right word here. Evidence is one thing, but what's different about this system is they're sort of imagining that there's someone other than, I don't want to say someone other than the judge, but there are people kind of in the room, talmidim, students, other people who might think that there is a point of law that is relevant to raise. And in that sense, the zechut may not be a new piece of exonerating evidence, but an argument for why there shouldn't be a conviction here. So that's a first point, which is to say, I think it's sort of broad, but it is in theory something new that hasn't been thought of or raised before, whether it's a piece of evidence or like a new legal argument in some way. Though I would say in that sense, it is sort of your worst nightmare as you're describing it of, well, when you try the case, it should be, we considered all the legal arguments and we made a judgment. And here there's a notion that someone might say, well, I have another way of thinking about it, right? Let's reconvene the panel.
And
on
by the
other
way,
hand, I think the other comment here, which is important, is, you know, you toggled back and forth between talking about a text and a system. And this is something we've reflected on throughout. It's not so clear how much of a system this ever was. And in that sense, there is a greater luxury of being able to say certain things that really encode values or a certain sympathy for how we want things to go that are not necessarily compatible with how a fully responsible justice system, you know, has to behave.
You know, the one thing I would add is that in our system, in the civil system now, it sort of almost works the other way. That is that if you want to appeal to a court of appeals, I mean, now we're not talking about new evidence. If you want to appeal to a court of appeals, you usually can't raise an issue that you didn't raise below.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that you came up with a new legal argument often doesn't work. Sometimes there are ways to do it, but normally a court of appeals isn't interested for obvious reasons, because they're reviewing what the court below did. And so it's sort of not fair to raise with the Court of Appeals an argument that you didn't raise below.
Right. Great. Yeah, I think that's a great contrast to this. And again, there's all sorts of things here that raise serious questions as to whether you could ever take the discussions of capital punishment in the Talmud and actually turn them into some kind of working system. Not just because, you know, how many people do you want to let off, but could it actually work even in the ways you're talking about how a caseload and a judicial bureaucracy needs to function. Great, thank you for sharing that.
I have a question, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Do we know historically whether the case of Mesit or Mediach was real? In other words, that's an avoda zara kind of a thing, right? Which certainly through Bayit Rishon we know, but these texts are coming way later than Bayit Rishon, right?
Right.
The earliest of these have to be, you know, by Cheney, you know, at the end, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, because there's a real difference between the first Midrash we went through where it's kind of like, no, you know, God is sitting there saying, I'll make sure it all turns out fine. You guys just do the, quote, right thing, or the just thing. And the Mesit Mediach, it's like, oh, no, we're not, you know, we're not playing games with this one. Was the Mesit Mediach still a real sort of historical thing at that point?
Yeah, so, I mean, ironically, in some ways, it seems the most sort of far-fetched case. Ironically, in certain ways, I would say the Mesit and the Mediach is probably the thing that has the best historical peg, which is to say the Sanhedrin court trial of Jesus in the Christian Bible is basically a Mesit Mediach case. And in Jewish literature throughout the ages, Yeshu HaNotzri was often described as a Mesit Mediach. Now, what's really going on there? Was there really a trial? How much of that is retrospective? Okay, we can ask all those questions. But I bring it up because the language of Mesit Mediach and there being this notion of inciting people to a wayward religious path was certainly a very live concern, and that person was a character for the Jewish community worried about people pulling people into different directions. such a, it's not, even if it was not something that was being formally carried out by a court, it was not like all kinds of other cases where they might have thought, you know, this sexual crime or that sexual crime, you know, demands some kind of capital response, but like no one was doing anything about that. This is real consequences of like how do communities treat people like that and how do they cut them off. So the rhetoric of lo tachmol ve lo tachaselav, even if not carried out as a bona fide capital case, could have real consequences for real people. Yeah.
Thanks.
Great. Thanks for picking up that angle too. Okay, good. The last piece here is really just asking, okay, so having established that there is this general rule where you are biased basically in favor of exoneration with the exception of the mesit, the insider, we now want to know where do chayvei galuyot and chayvei malkiyot fit into that. So again, someone is convicted. We think of the city of refuge, the Ir Miklat, when we read the Torah, as a place where you just go and run away to be protected. But if you pay attention, particularly in Bamidbar, chapter Lamed Hey, chapter 35, you find that the city of refuge has a whole atoning quality, like you're there, you're stuck there till the Kohen Gadol dies. It's clearly not just to evade someone who's in hot pursuit. There's something about being like cast into some kind of exile there. And the question is, when you have someone on trial for the kind of thing where they might end up being sent to an Ir Miklat, what happens there? Like if they're convicted to go to the Ir Miklat, does then someone who comes up with evidence that indicates that maybe they should totally get off? You know, in other words, it basically wasn't a manslaughter case at all. It was just something where they were not really guilty in any way of the person's death. Do you treat it the same? And the same thing with a case where someone is being convicted, being sentenced, as it were, to lashes for violating something in the Torah, does it work the same way? You just get these cryptic responses, atia rotzeach, rotzeach, atia rasha, rasha. The language of a gezeirah shavah, two distinctive terms that are being linked across the boundary here. If you just read Rashi, it gives us, you know, a tenable reading. I don't know if it's the only one going on here. Chayvei galut mai, mi have kedinei nefashot ila. Are those cases treated like capital cases for the purposes of reversal and non-reversal? And the answer that they are comes in the form of, well, k'tiv b'chayvei mitot yumata rotzeach, u'k'tiv b'chayvei galut lanus shama rotzeach. The word rotzeach is used in Bemidbar chapter Lamed Hey, both to refer to an intentional murderer and also to refer to the manslayer. And since the same term is used, even though there's different context and there's different consequences, that shows that the legal regime should be the same. And then similarly, Rasha Rasha, in the context of Dine Nefashot, again, with capital cases of murderers, we say there's a person, Asher Hu Rasha Lamut, someone who is a wicked person destined to die, okay? And the same term, Rasha, the verse I showed you a moment ago, Vayayin Bin Hakota Rasha, when you're beating the wicked person, that's used with respect to someone who is being administered a set of lashes. So that gives us the possibility of saying those two also have this principle of even if found guilty, you bring forward exculpatory evidence or a legal argument that will get them off. And if they were cleared, you do not bring them back because there is new incriminating evidence. And then Tanya Namiachi, a Braita Tanaitic text that confirms this, and just states it outright, chayvei galuyot minayin, how do we know that people who are found guilty of exile, of punishment of exile, follow the same rule? Rotzeach, rotzeach. How do we know it with people who have been sent, who have been given a punishment of lashes? Rasha, rasha. Okay, so that's the end of that piece. It's sort of grounded in a lot of verses, this notion of sending back, not sending back, and treating dine nefashot, and basically we see here other forms of corporal punishment, basically, in a different way. Okay, pause there for a second before we go to the next sugya. Question here, how quickly would the capital punishment take place? They're tied for an appeal. Yeah, here you're getting, I think, into the nitty-gritty of questions I don't think there are answers for, right? We got a little bit of how quickly it can't happen. They have to sleep on the capital judgment. And we had some of the stuff around Shabbat and other things in the Mishnah. We'll get into more of that. But again, do we have a real system here that's really being played out? I don't think I can tell you quite that here is actually right what happened, because as we've spoken about, the rabbis certainly were never given this degree of authority over capital punishment by the Roman Empire in any meaningful way. Again, whether for certain internal rebellious figures there might have been, you can talk about it. One of the classic critiques, I mentioned it already, of some of the New Testament scenes around the Sanhedrin's conviction of Jesus is basically claiming that there's no way in the reality of the Roman Empire that that actually ever could have been handed over to a Jewish court in that way. So, all right, questions of what's real here in terms of history, as opposed to how we think through the values that should be at stake here. Okay, great. I'm going to go on now to the next sugya. A lot shorter than last time's, right? This is the variability of the Talmud. I once, years ago, had the privilege of studying a semester with Professor David Weiss Halivni, and I remember him saying, it was a very striking thing, he said, you know, the Mishnah has like five different modes. Like once you've learned five different types of Mishnah, you've learned every type of Mishnah. Like you just are filling it with different content. Whereas there's like at least 50 to 70 forms of a Talmudic sugya, right? You're not just learning different, different content. You're learning totally different forms of things. So we're doing some of these short forms now. Okay, now, Ein Machzirin L'Chova. That was a kind of exegetical question of where do we know from the Torah, this notion that you return, don't return, revisit cases. Now we're going to ask the question of a little bit more of scope. When we say you don't undo an exoneration, okay? When we say you do not return to revisit a capital case to potentially convict after a person got off, how far do we take that principle? Put another way, are there not cases where, yeah, you would go back, you just discovered that the person is clearly a murderer or is clearly guilty of a capital crime? And here we're going to see, I think quite clearly, that the thing that you might be revisiting is not the evidence, but a question of a point of law, like it was wrongly decided in some basic way. Amar Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Vehu sheta'a bedavar she'ein hatzdukin modin bo. Aval ta'a bedavar she'atzdukin modin bo, zil kri bei ravhu. All right, so the only sense in which you don't overturn the verdict is if the error, all right, so here we're talking about an error, if the error made in the decision was something that the tzedukim, the Sadducees, the competing interpretive sect, the sect of Judaism that doesn't accept the oral law and rejects all kinds of modes of midrash, okay? If you made an error in something that they don't agree on, then that is the sort of thing that is enough of a gray area that we don't send it back because we have a bias towards the potential, victim, the potential executed, not the victim, the person who's been executed. Aval. But if the error was made in something that even a Sadducee would know was a mistake, that is to say, it is an error on something that is just, as Rashi here says here, right? A davar she'en hatzduki modimbo, she'en ta'uto miforash batorah bahedya. It's about something that's not explicitly in the Torah. Ela b'mishnah b'divrei ha'moraim. Like you forgot something in the Mishnah. But if the error was about something written in the Torah, then you basically tell the person, why don't you go back to school? That's zil kri be'rav. Okay? which is to say, that's just a null and void decision. You're not really even undoing it. It's just a joke. So of course, if the person got off because someone said, you know, someone came in and violated Shabbat, and they presented the evidence as a capital case, and the court said, well, you know, it never says in the Torah that you're executed for violating Shabbat. So though it was a bad thing you did, we let you off. That case gets retried, right? That case goes back because everyone knows that it says mechalaleh amot yumat in the Torah, all right? That's a sort of limit. Rabbi Yochanan is saying this is not just, no matter how cockamamie the decision, it stands, it has to have some legitimacy as being a reasonable judgment call within the parameters of rabbinic law. This should bring you back, rabbinic interpretation, bring you back to last week's sugya. We're talking about the ta'ut bidvar mishnah and the ta'ut b'shikul adat. This is not that, but it's a sort of parallel line they're trying to draw. Okay, now we get something kind of weird and interesting. Ba'amine Rabbi Chiya bar Abba me Rabbi Yochanan. So Rabbi Chiya bar Abba asks Rabbi Yochanan, ta'a b'no'ef v'no'efet mahu. I'm going to translate very literally here. What if the error had to do with a male and female adulterer? Is that considered to be a case of zil kri beirav? Like, is that so obvious that you reverse? Okay, now what does that mean? Let's go to Rashi for a minute to see at least what he says here. Ta'a b'no'ef v'no'efet. And here the Bach amends, all right? He sort of thinks the words got jumbled here. It should be ta'a b'no'ef v'no'efet and then mahu, okay? But let's just read it this way. Zika, let's assume that they got an innocent verdict, okay? That they were cleared, okay? Mi amrinan mehadrinan le lechova. Do we say in the case of a trial about adultery that if the people got off, you go back? Why? Dibishlama birotzeach ika lemite bemile tuva delomifarshe behedya. In a case of murder, there are a lot of things where you can imagine someone making a mistake on all kinds of details that are not explicit in the text. Kigon beomer even sheharagoba lo hayaba kedei mita. Okay, that for instance, you could have a case where someone said, you know, the rock that he killed that guy with wasn't actually big enough to cause a fatal blow. And therefore I suspect actually the rock didn't kill him. The guy happened to die after being struck by the rock, but he wasn't actually killed by the force of the rock. That's a sort of not obvious thing that someone could, you know, be unclear. Oh, bimutre mi pi harug velo mi pi edim. Or you have to be warned. You've got to have someone say, hey, do you know you're about to commit a capital crime? And the person has to say, I understand that I'm doing it anyway. And only then can you execute them. What if the victim was the one who warned him as opposed to witnesses, which is procedurally invalid? You might not get those facts straight, or you might confuse, you know, the point of law as to what is allowed there. O be omer hu haya rodfeini, v'yachol lehatzil be'achad me'evara, v'lo yitzil el harago. Or a case where someone says, I was acting in self-defense, but actually he could have acted in self-defense by shooting the guy in the leg. And he didn't shoot the guy in the leg, instead he killed him. Okay, these are things where you might be unclear on the exact parameters of the law. Says Rashi, I understand how you could have a ta'ut in that case. If there are two witnesses who saw the people commit adultery, that's it. There's no point of law that's vague here. As opposed to in a murder case, you could see what you think was a murder happen, and nonetheless, there might be a narrative where the person should get off. But there's no way, right? You can't say the act of adultery, you know, wasn't significant enough to be adultery. Like, they either see the act, in which case it's a capital crime, or they don't. So Rashi reads the question as, is no'efe no'efe, is the case of adultery a case where we can actually say that there's no way to, that the rules of backing out, as we've described them, apply. And then we get the following cryptic answer. Amarle, Rabbi Yochanan answers, Ademok dach yakid zil kotz karcha vitzali. While the fire is going, why don't you cut your gourd and roast it? Okay, now that's not so clear, right? What does that mean? All right, so let's go back to Rashi. Rashi reads this as, Be'od she'aish doleket, while the fire is going, kitzotz dluin, chop down some pumpkins, gourds, your gourds, v'tzaleotan, and roast them. Klomar, be'od she'atah osek, bishma'atcha, ten lev la'vin u'lehosif lekach. As long as you're busy sort of learning Torah, why don't you pay closer attention to really understand what's going on? Hare shamata mimeni, didn't you listen to me? I just told you a minute ago that when it's something that the Sadducees concede, then you reverse the case. And this is a thing that the Sadducees agree on, meaning they agree that there's a death penalty for adultery. And therefore, yes, in fact, if someone lets an adulterous man and woman off of a conviction of a death sentence, you go back and revisit it and convict them. Okay? That's how Rashi understands the flow here. Let's take it through to the end, and then I'm going to show you a different reading. So if that's right, okay, and you can basically always bring back a case of adultery to convict someone after they were let off. So how would you ever end up with a case of ein chozrin? Meaning the Mishnah said, dine nefashot, you don't bring them back in order to convict people. And dine nefashot presumably includes all kinds of dine nefashot, including arayot, including sexual crimes. There must be a subset of sexual crimes that is not reversible, right? Where there's a tzaddik, as it were, of someone who gets exonerated, and then even though there's now an argument, right, potentially for them being convicted, you don't go back. Amar Rabbi Abba, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, kegon sheta'a shelo kedarka. There was an error in the understanding of the law, where essentially adultery, according to rabbinic law, can happen, and one can be culpable for it, whether one is intimate with the other person in the normal way or in an unusual way, in a backwards way, shelo kedarka, okay? And someone might have not understood that too is a kind of libel form of intercourse. And that kind of ta'ut, that kind of an error, though it's an error, is something that the tzedukim don't know about. Because the Torah just talks about adultery, it does not specify positions. And therefore, even if rabbinic law has a broad understanding of which positions classify as adultery, someone might have a wrongful decision to exonerate someone who committed adultery in that way. And nonetheless, what's done is done. They get off because of this principle of dine nefashot. So here what we learn, really going back to Judge Bartnoff's point also, is that certainly in the scope of what we're talking about here, is people coming up with questions of law that they think were wrongly decided. And what's really being sharpened here is that indeed, we are talking about cases where from a rabbinic perspective, someone was wrongly freed, right? Like really, the facts were the facts and the law was clear, but there was an incorrect decision on a matter of law. Nonetheless, you can't send it back because it's dine nefashot. And that goes back to this language of a tzaddik al taharog, right? Someone who actually, and that's that marvelous use of tzaddik. Tzaddik means someone who was wrongly acquitted. You may not kill someone, who is wrongly acquitted. All right, that's where we sort of end up here. All right, now let me show you just one more thing on this, and then we can take a couple of questions, and there are a couple of comments here. So this phrase, Ademokdach yakid zil kotz karcha vitzali. All right, there's a little chet here that they put here, all right, which takes you up to here, which tells you, go look in the Aruch, in Rav Natan Bar Yechiel's 11th century dictionary of Talmudic terms, the Aruch, in entry Kuf Dalet, the second entry of Kuf Dalet, and you'll see a perush nifla u'mishubach, an amazing and fantastic explanation of this phrase. So you don't have the Aruch, but you do have screen share with me, who has pulled up the Aruch, which I have right here. This is Alexander Kohut's Aruch HaShalem, which is a reworking sort of three levels, basically, of commentary on the original Aruch. But this is the 11th century text here. It's an amazing, really interesting text. It's just basically a Talmudic dictionary, but that functions also like a commentary. And it goes through all kinds of different passages. So here you see in Kad, in that entry, it says here in Perek Echad Dinei Mamonot, Ta'a benoef venoefet mahu. Amar le ademok, ademok dach yakid kotz karcha vetzali. Okay? And now he's going to give a totally different perush. Again, to the Torah readers out there, we're all unfortunately getting rusty these days, but for the Torah readers among you out there, noef v'noefet is the words male and female adulterer. But if I pronounced it as noef v'noafet, noef v'noafet is actually a phrase from the Torah. It's a pasuk. And it's suggestive that perhaps it's not just a case of adultery, but perhaps a way of reading the psukim that's at stake here. And this is sort of an amazing potential thought experiment here. Perush. Kigon she'amru al hanoef hechmira Torah she'ne'emar ve'el eshet amitcha lo titen shechovtecha le'noefet lo hizhira mahu. What if there was a court that when faced with an adultery case, this is a totally different reading than Rashi, when faced with an adultery case said, you know what, we're going to put the man to death, but not the woman. Why? Because actually, if you look in Vayikra Yudchet, in the list of the arayot of forbidden sexual relationships, it says, don't sleep with your neighbor's wife. But it doesn't say anything about her. It never tells her not to do anything. So the court might say, the no'ef, the Torah was strict with, but the no'efet, there was no warning. Amar le. Rabbi Yochanan responds to that query. Is that the kind of case that you return? Is that a gross error or not? Ademokdach yakid kotz karcha v'tzale. Ad sheh esh yokedet litzliat kare. Re'eh kemo shetzolin otan. While the fire is going and people are roasting gourds, why don't you go see how they're roasted? Verutz chatoch tzlei gamata. And why don't you bring your own gourd and you go roast it? All right, so now while the bonfire is going and they're roasting marshmallows, go grab your own marshmallow and toast it. Klomar, what does that mean? Imencha yodea tzliat kare, hine mokdal tzliatam, rutz re'e vilamed. Okay? That is to say, it's kind of an insult of what kind of moron doesn't know how to roast squash? And it could be a lot of us, but right, that seems to have been the way the Aruch understood it. And therefore, I suggest, why don't you go take squash roasting 101, is what this means. Kach eino yodea di noef v'noefet. Ha mikra male mot yumat hanoef v'hanoafet. That is to say, the way the Aruch reads it is, this is not a statement back to Rabbi Yochanan's colleague of, hey, listen up, I already provided you the answer for this. It's what you would say to a judge who made that kind of error. A judge who made the error that there is there is a difference between the Noef and the Noefet, is someone who should be told, you don't seem to know how the Torah works. Yes, obviously, rhetorically, this means that the case is reversed. But what's great about this is the Noef and Noefet is also then the actual Pasuk, right? Mikra male, mot yumat, hanoef vehanoafet. And that is then tying it back into the actual verse that they were supposed to be understanding in the right way. Okay, that's a kind of fascinating and cheeky little back and forth there that I think gives you also a nice sense of sort of the role that the psukim are playing in all of this. All right, we got a couple questions here. Yeah, who were the judges? There doesn't seem to be so much respect for them. Absolutely. There is, so part of this is like, okay, kind of, is this the sort of imaginary world that, you know, who knows how much it's playing out? How much is there a sort of a memory, which does seem to have a historical reality of like tzdukim and prushim, sort of proto-rabbinic and proto-non-rabbinic forces kind of contending for power, and this being a way of sort of mocking other modes of interpretation, right? So they, one way is to say, who are these judges? Maybe they were idiots. The other way is, I don't know, you can hear various echoes of denominational disputes today on these things where people, you know, approach people with other interpretive frameworks in sort of contemptuous ways. But the other thing is, this is playing out in a capital context, but again, I think certainly in a monetary context, we have to remember these judges, we saw this sort of in the Rabbi Tarfon case, these judges are kind of being selected by the people who are approaching them. And the same way that there are people who pass themselves off as having expertise who may not have a high level of expertise, but who might nonetheless command either the loyalty or get the business of people who don't have a lot of other options. We may be getting a window into some of that as well. Great. Why is the assumption that every category of capital crimes needs to have a way in which an exoneration cannot be overturned? Yeah, that's a little bit of a weird move. I agree. Do you have another way of how you could have understood Rabbi Yochanan's statement? Like at the end when he says, "Kigon sheta'a shelo kedarkah," he seems to assume that that's a big category of dinei nefashot. I think it's just it would be bizarre. Now, there's an entire enormous category of dinei nefashot, which is the arayot, that would be somehow exempt from this rule. I have to think about how the Aruch's reading plays into that, because if you follow the Aruch's reading, it's not sort of every case of adultery, right? It's one particular way of reading that distinction. So I have to think about it. I don't know, Adin, you have a further thought on that, or just a question?
Yeah, actually, the explanation you gave actually sounds pretty sound like to me that it's just too big of a category. It's like if we're that big of a caveat, like this whole category doesn't fall into this rule, then the Mishnah should have explicitly said that.
Yeah. Okay. Rachel, do you want to give this articulation to what you're asking here? What distinction are you looking for, and wonder if it applies in cases of rape?
Yeah, just like the distinction between the no-ef and the no-efet. Like, does that distinction and how we treat the woman and the man not pave the way for a conversation for unconsensual relations?
Yeah, so again, to be clear here, that's a rogue interpretation that they're imagining is so at odds with any reasonable reading of the Torah, it's to be struck down, such that any coherent reading of the Torah, in the case of the Noef and the Noefet, would be it's a consensual act on the part of both parties, therefore they are both fully culpable. Torah itself already lays out that in the case of a rape, the victim of the rape is not culpable in any way. Such that in any actual adjudication of the law, that would be totally clear. Is that what you were asking, or also asking whether in a case of a rape there would ever be, you know, reversal or revisiting? I mean, there was an earlier, was it from you? Did you also put the comment about victims earlier?
Yeah.
So, right. I think that is a complicated and interesting, right? Just going back to what you wrote here, right? Is there a notion of victims' rights, justice for victims? And the ways in which that can lead to all kinds of problematic things. but also is an effort to pursue justice, right, from a different angle that otherwise is not being recognized. That is not a I have to think about whether that shows up anywhere. It is certainly not a driving or characteristic force, right? And again, I think it goes back to the Mechilta that we started with, which is on some level, right, God is the avenger in this system. And the overall feeling is you believe in the just and righteous God, and you are God's deputy on earth to carry out executions for certain things that are black on white. You've gotten all the evidence properly. Everything has checked out. The second there is some hint of a legal or factual loophole, God sort of revokes your ambassadorship. you're no longer on that job. And I think that's a sense in which a more robust theory of victims' rights, it would be like, yeah, but you're not going to play that out through the criminal justice system. That's what these texts would say. So I would expect you would find that, but you would find it in a sort of agotic mode of, here's how God goes out in the world and tries to defend those people, but not in the hallways of Dine Nefashot, right? Yeah, no, I think that's actually a really important distinction. We'll see if it comes up at all later in the chapter, but I think it's largely absent. Any other reflections or thoughts before we pause here? We're not gonna start the next bit, which takes us into yet another piece of exegesis of what Edim do and who gets to justify and do various things. Yes, right, correct. I thought there was something that was recent. Correct, the Goel Hadam is a real vitiation of that whole claim, right? What was the language? Mishum chovate de goel adam katlin an le lahai. That's right, exactly right. Thank you for bringing that back to the top of the pile, Adam. There's a real actually pushing it to the side. Now it could be that the chovate, I mean, I don't know, right? What counts? Are there different levels of that? But yeah, that seems to be a statement. That's, I think, a good response to your point, Rachel. I don't remember if you were here for that piece last week, but if not, the top of Lamed Gimel Amud Bet is worth revisiting on that front. Terrific. I look forward to seeing everyone next week. 8:00, we'll be back. We're going to be moving to our next Amud, moving into Lamed Dalet Amud Aleph next time, and plowing forward. Pleasure as always.